It feels great. There's no other way to put it. I mean, it's so easy to say, yeah, we want to win the World Series. I've been very fortunate my entire career to feel like I've had a team that we had a chance to win a World Series, and I've only been there twice, and that's over 12-plus years. So it's not easy. I don't take any of this for granted. This is what we play for. These are the experiences that you remember at the end of your career when you look back, you know, winning these games, playing in the World Series, hopefully winning a World Series. I think I've been here for, somebody said, like 50 days now. To feel this bonded to a team in a city that quickly, I think is something special.
I'm really proud of my players and coaches. We were prepared. We knew we needed to get off to a great start. We certainly have a great deal of respect for USC, and this rivalry is one where our guys were excited about it. We made them aware of the history and tradition of it. We actually spent a little bit more time on how important this game was. Never did we take away from our preparation and how important that is. The turnovers obviously were key for us in the first half, and being opportunistic, which has been really what we've been all year, getting up 28-0, you know, put us in such a great position in the second half to come back and get our program back to where it needed to be. And so all the credit goes to the players that were part of that. Just really proud of our players and coaches, and really good win for our football team.
And with our team, we saw it with our team. Nobody else can help us but us, and put our best people on it, you know, our players and our coaches. They were hitting on all cylinders. Yeah, quarterback was hot, and receivers made plays downfield, and it was impressive. Their execution was really good tonight, right from the beginning. Then we got a little bit under control, and then they came back and hit the quarterback sucker play. We're going to regroup. We're going to refit, retool, and get back to work. More opportunities ahead of us.
Routine run play. I mean, I've done it a million times where you're just blocking a guy and you go to try to finish him and get one last shove, one last push, and you just felt something unnatural in your arm. You kind of are in an out-of-body experience a little bit. I think you have an idea of what happened, at least, and you're trying to figure out if it's something that you can continue on with, if you can get up and keep playing. But effectively, I really didn't have any function in my left arm, and I think you can play about 30% or 40% function with your one arm, but when you have no function in one arm, it's hard to block. Definitely proud of the number of plays I was able to put together getting over that 10,000 milestone and going into my 11th season without missing a play. Is something that I always feel like I'll be able to hang my hat on and I can have pride in. It's a violent game, and those type of streaks, they always are going to come to an end.
That one's really personal to me. You know, he's a huge part of what we do, a huge part of his organization, and we'll see where that is. But that was a big blow, you know, because obviously those things, with him over there, it changes the game on how you have to call the game, try to protect those type of things. And they took advantage of that as we went. That's what good teams do. It's disappointing. I'm sure that he don't want the yo-yo, but it goes both ways. Developing quarterbacks, they still got to do what you ask them to do. So in that process of developing a quarterback, I want them to not turn the ball over. That's the name of the game. And again, I'm going to say it again, it's still about the football team. It's not just about one individual. It's about the team.
Yeah, I'm not here to talk about my personal life right now.
That doesn't show a lack of commitment to learning the job?
Absolutely not. You know, I was out and was at the facility the next day, you know, preparing for a game, was preparing for the game right before that. So, once again, I'm not here to talk about my personal life.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. It is the Extravaganza back. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. We got a lot of weekend stuff to wrap up today and a lot of analysis to do. Want you to be a part of it whenever you feel like it at 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065. You want to talk? We'll talk. If you just want to listen, that's okay. I got lots to say. You can do that too, but I want to hear you if you've got something to say. Boy, oh boy, I mean, a lot of stuff in the montage there. The World Series is set. How about your boy, Justin Verlander? He will be the subject of today's wild stat of the day, which you'll have in about 20 minutes, and I'm looking forward to giving you that. He has just been crazy good for the now American League champions. You know what, Kush? We can no longer call the Indians the defending American League champions.
No, that's true. You know, another thing that over the course of the weekend, since this game was Saturday night, that I've come to grips with as an Indians fan, Bob, yeah our Indians had that streak and finished with more wins than the Astros, but if you flash yourself back to May, this would have been the World Series matchup you would have wanted, because even back then, These are probably the best two teams from start to finish in each league this year, and that's
agreed,
always nice to see.
Although in the second half, I thought the Indians rightly pushed past the Astros yes. as being the best team in the American League, and at the time in baseball because of the second half that the Dodgers yeah. had, particularly the last month and a half in which they struggled so mightily. So yeah, if you'd have said in May and April and May, hey, who should be in the World Series? You're right. You're right. You would have said this, but guess what? The thing isn't decided World Series or isn't decided in April and May. To me, the way things went in the second half going into the playoffs, the two teams that I would have picked in this would have been the Indians, certainly from the American League, and I don't know, maybe the Cubs or Nationals from the National League because of the Dodgers, the way they slid into the finish of this whole thing. But you know what? They rose up. Both of them did. They rose up in the postseason. The Indians did not. And justifiably, this is your World Series, Astros and Dodgers. Not what the media wanted. Media wanted Yankees and Dodgers, yep. L.A., New York, you know, the coastal, bi-coastal series, the whole nine yards. They haven't done that since, what, 1978, I want to say, is the last time?
81.
81?
81. The Dodgers won that one in 81.
Thank you. So, you know, this is what they wanted, but they didn't get it. So they got Astros, and it still might be the best matchup, you know, considering the options when you had the two league championship series going. I think Houston and L.A. is better than what you probably would have wanted. You know, probably better than Houston and Chicago, probably better than well, New York and Chicago still would have been pretty good, too. New York and L.A. is probably the one they wanted the most. But
TV-wise, absolutely.
This is the best matchup from a baseball standpoint.
Yeah, I agree with that assessment. From a TV standpoint, they would have wanted Yankees and Dodgers. But from a pure baseball standpoint, especially with our Indians having been gone now for a couple weeks, this right. is the matchup we would have wanted.
So we'll get into that a little bit later on. You also heard from Brian Kelly. What the hell did Notre Dame just do to the Trojans of Southern California? Holy dog blank. I mean, are you kidding me? You heard Brian referencing up 28-0. Yeah, they came out like gangbusters. They led that game 28-0 at the half, poured it on in a 49-14 win over number 11, Southern Cal. Clearly, Southern Cal was a little bit overrated this year, like another team a little closer to Northwest Ohio that we'll talk about in a moment. Clearly, Southern Cal was a little bit overrated, but clearly, Notre Dame wasn't. They were extraordinarily underrated in the preseason rankings, and now Notre Dame football, stirring the echoes, if you will, looks to be back and better than they have been for a very, very long time. You cannot understate the importance of not just the win over USC, but the dominating
yes.
performance that they gave. I mean, if 13 Notre Dame beats 11 USC, especially after Notre Dame suffered that loss to Georgia earlier on, and a lot of people were really, really on Brian Kelly's case, myself included, hand in the air, guilty.
Yep, this show definitely guilty of that.
Amen. If you'd have just said, hey, they bounced back and won and moved to 6-1 with a win over the 11th rated team in the country, a rivalry game no less against the likes of USC, you know, we would have said, holy cow, what an amazing turnaround for them. They're going in the right direction. But beating them 49-14, pounding them into submission the way that they did, it's not just going in the right direction. It's tee it up now. You are on a mission for the college football playoffs. If you're a Notre Dame fan now, if you're a Golden Domer, the only thing you are thinking about now is the fact that you control your own destiny. You take care of business against the USC. Now you look at the rest of the schedule and you say, okay, another ranked team. This isn't going to be an easy game. You got 14th NC State coming up on Saturday. But you've proven that you are not shying away from the bright lights of a top 15 showdown. You can do it a second time. If you did it to USC, you can certainly do it to NC State. Wake should be a cake. Walk, then Miami at Coral Gables. That's your. Let's separate the men from the boys. Do we really feel like going into the postseason, meaning in the playoffs, and not just a New York Six game or not? Navy, Stanford, another top 20 team. So three top 20 teams await as of the rankings today. They may not be that at the time you play them, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But Notre Dame has five games left and an opportunity to absolutely cement themselves into the national championship picture for the first time since they got blown out in the national championship game in the Manti Te'o catfishing year, which was what, 12 or 13? Can't exactly remember when they got blown out in that championship game. Doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. Point is, huge win for Brian Kelly and the Golden Domers.
Yeah.
Very, very happy for them. Well, more happy for the players than I am Brian Kelly. I'm still not a fan of his.
Right.
But be that as it may, he must get credit.
Yes.
You know, it's like LeBron James. I'm not a fan of LeBron James. When he does great things, he must get credit. There's a lot of New York Yankees, not a fan of them. But when they do great things, they must get credit. I'm not a fan of a lot of teams and players like anybody else who's a fan. There are guys you like, guys you don't like. But, you know, in honesty, if you're being honest with yourself, you have to recognize greatness when you see it. And the performance that Notre Dame has put together in the last several weeks since the Georgia loss has indeed been great.
Yep.
And Brian Kelly deserves the kudos for that.
And that's well said, by the way. That to me, sums the whole thing up. Yeah, there's a couple ranked opponents coming up. One this week, a tough game at Miami in a couple of weeks. And technically, as of this moment, Stanford, you know, is still a ranked team to end the season. But, yeah, 11. Well, say they win out. There's no way the committee is keeping out an 11-1 Notre Dame from the top four.
They don't have a conference championship to win. So it's just on the regular season body of work. They don't have a conference championship game to have. In that way, they're a little bit like the Big 12 had been in the last few years, as you know, we've talked about. You know, do they get a shot at winning to impress the committee to win a conference championship? And it's been hurting them, I think, that they didn't have one of those. This is a non-conference team, so all you have is to go on as the regular season body of work. And the fact that it is Notre Dame, by the way, which, you know, let's be honest, you know, a lot of people have been tired of Notre Dame getting the favorable treatment from pollsters in AP polls and in the coaches' polls and in other ranking systems because of the history of Notre Dame. Oftentimes it hasn't been deserved. And if they're going to get overrated in those rankings in times when they haven't really deserved it because of their name, then you damn well better believe they're going to be overrated or properly rated in this case when they are great and playing great and deserving of a spot in college football's playoffs.
Yep, so and that's
got 5 weeks to settle that.
And that's the whole point. That I didn't think we'd actually be at this point at any point this season, but yeah, starting now, Notre Dame officially on playoff watch.
No question about it. One team that is not on playoff watch, speaking of overrated teams, would be your Michigan Wolverines. That would be your Michigan Wolverines, Bill Michaels. Yes, your Michigan Wolverines. You know what, Kush? I take no pleasure in this. The fact that here we are on October 23rd, Michigan has fallen out of the top 25. They have fallen down out of the top 10. Remember, they started the season ranked 8th in the AP and coaches polls. And I sat here on this radio station in front of this microphone on these airwaves, and I said, are you kidding me? That seems extraordinarily high and undeserved for a team that is losing 10 defensive starters and 7 offensive starters. And it does not have a superstar Heisman candidate player that you can say, well, this guy can cure a lot of your ills. They are a team that was going to have to be really, really good in all phases of the game, trying to hold off teams as they develop some experience, et cetera, and try to grow their record. And I just didn't think it was really in the cards for them to do that this year. The 8th ranking, I thought, was just a lot high. Well, lo and behold, when they lost to Sparty, it was proven right that ranking was certainly not deserved, even though it went up a little bit, too, with a couple of earlier season wins.
Mm-hmm.
Then, and they have now lost 2 out of 3, of course. The 2 losses we'll talk about, but the win in the middle of them, sandwiching the 2 losses, was a very uninspiring, unimpressive overtime win over an overmatched Indiana team at Bloomington, 27-20 in OT. But before and after that, the loss to Sparty at 14-10 and now the blowout to Penn State has knocked them down from 8th where they were to, I think they were at 17 going into this game. And now, of course, after being blown out by the Nittany Lions, they are all the way out of the top 25. And I'm not sure whether that loss represents more about how good Penn State is heading into the Ohio State showdown this week in Columbus, or if it says really how overrated Michigan was, that their defense, while putting up really great numbers in terms of, you know, national rankings, being one of the highest-rated defenses, the highest-rated statistically defense in FBS going into that game, that will certainly change. But whether or not it says more about Penn State's greatness as the number two team in the country or Michigan's real, real problems, I'm not really certain at this point in time. Maybe a little bit more of the former and a little bit less of the latter, but some of each, because Penn State and Saquon Barkley looked very, very good as expected, and John O'Korn did not. Not that this is all on the fifth-year senior quarterback who is playing only because of the injury to Wilton Spate, but the Michigan offense is not even close to being a big-time college football threat. Not with O'Korn at the helm, not with kind of a cache of running backs, none of them really kind of emerging, even though Higdon did do some great things a week ago in that 200-yard performance he had against Indiana. It's just not a consistent thing. And obviously the Michigan defense, when facing the Tracy McSorley led offense and Saquon Barkley on the ground, it was just not meant to be. And this is the right thing. This is. I don't want to say Michigan should have started the season outside the top 25, but when they started number 8, it was a joke. And I said they probably should have been in the upper portions of the 20s, or in other words, up to 25. They probably should have been in the 22-3-4 range, in my opinion, based on everything they lost and everything they had back. And I think right now we're finding out that this Michigan program, while turned around very, very quickly from the Brady Hoke days to the Jim Harbaugh days, still has quite a ways to go before they can call themselves a national power. Agreed or disagreed?
No, I have to agree with that, and it is definitely some of both. I mean, you know, Michigan is proving, I think, sadly, that they were overrated coming into the beginning of the season. You got to be concerned.
Sadly, but not surprisingly.
Right. You got to be concerned, I think, based on everything, all in the conglomerate these last couple of weeks. Because I'm glad you mentioned the Indiana game. Yeah, it goes in the books as a W, but it easily could have been an L. And it wasn't that great of a game from a Michigan standpoint. There, it's just the fact that really at the end of the day, they were playing Indiana. Most other teams in that situation, not named Indiana, they might have very well lost that game. And then we see what happened on the sandwich game, losing to Little Brother and then getting blown out. And then on the flip side, I know a lot of people, myself included, have been kind of in a wait-and-see mode when it comes to Penn State. And maybe Michigan specifically isn't the greatest of barometers, but, man, this team is for real. They are scary good. And I think Ohio State's going to have more than their hands full coming up on Saturday.
I do, too. I was talking about the next week's game with my father-in-law, who's a mad, huge Ohio State fan, mm-hmm. went to Ohio State, 85-year-old fan, and he was talking about the game. And I told him yesterday, I said, you know, it's a coin flip. It really is a coin flip game. I would give the edge to the home team here, but I feel like the schedule favors Penn State rather than Ohio State in what might be a very backwards way of looking at this. You would believe, and I said last week, Ohio State gets to sit back this week and relax and watch Penn State play Michigan, which is a big challenge for them, for Penn State, that is, while Ohio State has a bye week, and you think, boy, oh boy, a huge advantage to Ohio State there, and that very well could be the story. But as I said to him yesterday, I feel like Penn State is going to be more battle-tested and ready than Ohio State on Saturday, solely because Ohio State has spent the last 5 weeks eating at a buffet. I mean, just they're feasting on a buffet of bad teams. They have spent, since the Oklahoma loss, they got Army, an easy 38-7 win. They got UNLV, an easier 54-21 win. They got Rutgers, an easier 56-0 win. They got a terrible Maryland team, a 62-14 win. And then they got a really bad Nebraska team and 56-14. They've spent 5 weeks feasting on cupcakes. They're going to have stomach aches, as many cupcakes as they've eaten over the last 5 weeks. And now here comes Penn State into town. I don't know that they're going to be ready. This is the first time they will have been challenged since Oklahoma when they lost. Where? At home. So Penn State, on the flip side of that, coming in here after having played Michigan, knowing this is the first game, by the way, of that little gauntlet,
yes,
if you will. But they come in just a little bit more battle-tested because of the challenge of Michigan, which proved to be no challenge to them. Now, I'm not saying that they've played, you know, a murderer's row, you know, in beating Akron and Pitt, and, well, Pitt is a rivalry game, so that's always tough.
Honestly, Bob, I'm looking at Penn State's schedule. Prior to Saturday, the only real impressive game was the road game at Iowa, because that's always tricky for some reason for a lot of people.
Well, yeah, it is. It is.
But the rest of the schedule is kind of cupcake.
And they won that. You know, and then obviously they got a Big Ten win over Northwestern, which isn't very good this year as well. But they did have Michigan being, you know, the whiteout game and the biggest game of the year for them to that date, right before Ohio State, and they answered it with flying colors. They answered the bell or passed the test with flying colors. I think I mixed my metaphors there. But you understand the point. They are coming off of a challenge game with huge momentum.
Yep.
Ohio State is coming in with a little bit of a tummy ache from all those cupcakes they've eaten. So if there is any advantage to be gained in this matchup, which I think is a coin flip, talent for talent, Ohio State and Penn State on Saturday should be just a coin flip pick'em Vegas game. I don't know what the line is. Do you?
For this one, let me see if it's out.
I could be right that it is exactly what I just said.
Right now, Buckeyes by 6.5. That feels like a lot.
Oh, that's insane.
That's insane.
That's insane. I'm sorry, Vegas. You know what? Maybe they're still. I don't know. I'm not gonna comment on that. I think it's a pick'em game. If there is an edge to be held for Ohio State, it is the fact that it's home.
Yeah.
If there is an edge to be held for Penn State, it is the fact that they're coming off of a challenge game and should be feeling very good about how they answered the bell there, while Ohio State has not been challenged at all since the loss to Oklahoma. So there's just a little bit of a thumbnail sketch breakdown of how that one, I think, is going to go. We'll talk more about that as we continue. And then the last part of the montage was Joe Thomas and Hugh Jackson and DeShone Kizer. It is time. Out there in Cleveland, it is time. Hugh Jackson must be fired. He should be fired today. He should be fired today for a variety of reasons. But he should not be in that car driving out of the parking lot out there in Berea where they practice by himself. He ought to have Sashi Brown and Paul DePodesta sitting in the car with them. All of them should be run out of town on a rail. It has become an absolute embarrassment out there for that franchise. Make no mistake about it. What they continue to do to DeShone Kizer, now people turning on DeShone Kizer because he went out on Friday night trying to turn this into a Johnny Manziel type story, which is garbage. I'll explain why later. Hugh Jackson declining penalties, declining a 15-yard penalty when it's 3rd and 1 in the opening drive for the Titans, instead of pushing them back and out of field goal range, allowing them to go for it on 4th and 1, moving in for an easy chippy. I mean, he is clueless on how to handle quarterbacks. He is clueless on how to handle game situations. He's clueless on play calling. And his buddies in the front office, DePodesta and Sashi Brown, the lawyer and the baseball scout, have assembled the worst roster in football. They should all be run out of town right now today. And I'll talk more about that when the time is right. Coming up, after the bottom of the hour local sports center, we're going to talk more about the Michigan loss. Our friend Anthony Broom from AzeandBrew.com will break down Michigan's loss to Penn State and what it means about the rest of their season. And we'll do all of that after we check the Wild Stat.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents the Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings, wings, beer, sports.
Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day about Justin Verlander. I mentioned it earlier on Little Tease. In the span of a month and a half, JV has gone from the ace of a weak, terrible Tiger staff and team to the ace of the Astros staff, which is in the World Series. And, oh, by the way, he's the American League Championship Series MVP. In that time in Houston, his numbers are like video game-like. Counting the regular season and the playoffs, Verlander, in 8 starts and 9 appearances with the Astros, is 9-0 with a 1.22 ERA. And that's crazy. That is video game-like. That is amazing. And it really, really could not happen to a better guy who really deserves this chance to get a world championship after being jettisoned from the rebuilding Tigers. What a tremendous opportunity. He is seizing every bit of it. talking about Justin Verlander. That's your Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day. Local Sports Center coming your way. Then we're back talking Michigan football and more coming up right here on the ticket.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza. ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
With our team, we saw it with our team. Nobody else can help us but us. And put our best people on it. You know, our players and our coaches. They were hitting on all cylinders. Yeah, quarterback was hot, and receivers made plays downfield, and it was impressive. Their execution was really good tonight, right from the beginning. Then we got a little bit under control, and then they came back and hit the quarterback sucker play. We're gonna regroup. We're gonna refit, retool, and get back to work. More opportunities ahead of us.
Make a little bit of sense of that profound statement by Jim Harbaugh. Nobody can help us but us. Well, that's probably a true statement. I don't think anybody at Penn State is going to try to help them. I don't think anybody at Michigan State was trying to help them. I don't think, quite frankly, that any of their future opponents are going to try to help them. So, yeah, nobody's going to help you but you. What the hell does that mean, Coach? A blowout loss at the hands of the Nittany Lions, essentially, is what it was. Another disappointment in a big game for Jim Harbaugh in his third year now, back as the head coach of the Michigan Wolverines. Big game losses are starting to pile up. Big game losses meaning games against Ohio State, games against Michigan State, and games against the likes of Penn State. They blew them out last year, so it's not obviously every time, but certainly when you're talking about a top five team, or in this case a top two team like Penn State, you wanted a better showing than a blowout loss. Not saying you had to beat this team, especially given where they are, but that has to be kind of starting to stick in the craw of diehard Maize and Blue fans. What about diehard Maize and Brew fans? Let's go to MaizeandBrew.com's Anthony Broom now for his thoughts on Michigan's latest big game defeat, falling to 5-2 on the season and putting essentially what had been a promising season into a little bit of a tailspin now moving into the final stretch. Anthony, good to talk to you. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm doing great. It's good to be back. It's been a minute. I know Drew was with you guys not too long ago, but you know, my voice has not been on these airwaves in a while, so I appreciate the opportunity.
It is good to have your voice back here breaking down all things Michigan. You're right. We had Drew doing a preview for us on Friday, as a matter of fact, and now you get to do the review, or as it turns out, the post-mortem over the corpse of the Wolverines that was carried out of a whited-out Happy Valley. Boy, what an experience when you do go there and they do the whiteout. Not an easy place for anybody to play, but my goodness, it just it was worse than I thought it would be. I thought Penn State would win in their own place. I hoped Michigan's defense, as highly ranked nationally as it was, would put up a bigger fight against Saquon Barkley and Tracy McSorley, and wasn't to be. I mean, it was every bit as ugly as I think that final score indicates that it was, Anthony.
Yeah, I mean, even when they got it to went up quickly, 14-0 within the first 5 minutes, you're going, oh boy, this is going to be a long night. And even when, you know, Michigan kind of fought back, got it to, 14-13, it still felt like it was an uphill battle. It didn't feel like that was a momentum swinger or anything like that. So, I mean, obviously you get back to 14-13 and then, Penn State walks right back down the field and, goes up at halftime. So, I mean, like you said, it was every bit as ugly as that score would indicate. And it really was, the first time this year that, this is a Michigan team that went up against a bunch of grown men, so to speak. I mean, this, Florida is what they are. They're a middling product right now.
Michigan State, obviously. They're getting death threats from their fans down there in Gainesville, by the way. I don't know if you saw that. So that lets you know where they are and puts into perspective that season opening win over the Gators. They've gone off the rails so bad. They're literally getting death threats down there in Gainesville. But sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, yeah, it's bad down there. But even Michigan State, Michigan State outplayed them. You can use the weather as an excuse. But that was still a young team, too. But this is the first time this year we've seen Michigan go up against, one of the big boys, so to speak. Like you said, it was every bit as ugly as it looked. I mean, their Penn State stars pretty much did it on their own. Barkley is the Heisman Trophy finalist. He's been built to be. Trace McSorley, I'm not sure there's a player in the Big Ten that has improved as much as he has, since Michigan blew out Penn State last year, just over a year ago. So, their best was far better than Michigan's best and showed just about every aspect on the field.
Anthony, Before we talk specifics, and I want to talk about Brandon Peters, whom I want to see tomorrow. Sorry about John O'Korn. You know, it's a sad story that he transferred in and things aren't working well. He didn't win the starting job last year. He didn't win it again this year, even as a fifth-year senior. And he's only playing because Spade is out. And he just doesn't have the goods to lead this team. I think everybody from Michigan is going to be looking to 2018 now. And I want to see Brandon Peters throw the ball. I would like to see McCaffrey throw the ball as well, but I know they probably want to keep him as a redshirt, so you don't want to waste that opportunity there. But aside from all of the individual things like that, do you agree with what I said in my intro to you that fans are probably starting to get a little bit tired of the big game losses against rivals, against top five or top ten teams? You know, Jim Harbaugh was brought in not just to restore the glory and the powerhouse stature of the Michigan program that had been lost since Lloyd Carr left. But he was also brought in to win these kinds of games, and he's not. And I don't know if you can just blame it all on, hey, it's still his third season. He doesn't have all of the kinds of guys he would like to recruit there to build his type of team yet. He's only had a couple of classes. If that's the answer, or if that's the excuse, or if there is no excuse, what's your take, and how do you think Michigan fans feel about the big game losing from Harbaugh?
Yeah, let me preface it by saying this. I do, in a way, feel bad for Jim Harbaugh, but I don't, because he's making $9 million a year. So with that price tag comes that expectation.
True. Very well said.
But, you know, when I look at this, and you kind of alluded to it just a few minutes ago, you know, to me, the 2018 season for them begins Saturday against Rutgers, and it starts with them, you know, getting Brandon Peters involved. Hopefully, that should be the plan. There's no point in having John O'Korn out there now.
No.
It serves nobody any good. When I look at Harbaugh, I mean, need to step back a little bit of perspective here. I know the assumption was that he's going to come in here and flip the switch right away, and in a lot of ways he has. I mean, that Michigan is, you know, going into even last week's game, still is still relevant in the, you know, the Big Ten hunt, the national title talk still, speaks volumes about, you know, where they've come in just a few short years. Disappointing how last year ended. But let's be real here. I mean, this program coming out of the Brady Hoke era was a disaster, an unmitigated disaster. It took a couple years of Hoke guys, won 20 games with, you know, a bunch of guys who, you know, had trouble winning, you know, 10 games combined in the two seasons before that. So, I mean, it is tough, and I feel bad because you lost a lot last year. I mean, from last year. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, and even the guys you have now, what's weird to me about Jim Harbaugh is that we've always seen him be a guy who, you know, best players are going to be on the field, freshman, sophomore, senior, whatever. The concerning thing to me is that, you know, it seems like there still are some older guys in the lineup, and we're not seeing perhaps what the best players on the field are. So that tells me two things. It's either A, you're concerned about, you know, these young guys getting a little too exposed early on, or B, the young guys that you're recruiting to bring in here aren't good enough. So which one is it? And that's where I say, you know, we need to start seeing Brandon Peters. The guys on the offensive line, I mean, you know, they've recruited some guys that you'd like to see get in there. Cesar Ruiz at center, Chuck Filiaga at tackle. You know, I know we're concerned about red shirts and all, but, you know, at some point, you need to get a look at and see who else can do other things. And if they're not performing in practice, then it is what it is there too. But, you know, people are frustrated right now, and they should be. I mean, it's, you know, I picked Michigan to win that game last week because, you know, I thought they had the defense to do it. I thought at some point, everyone telling you can't do something, maybe that would stick in their craw and they'd come out and shock the world. But they're going, I knew this was going to be a rough year for this team, or at least getting young guys worked in. There were going to be growing pains. But those growing, I mean, they've gotten worse every week, and that's my biggest concern right now, is that I don't see guys being coached up. In fact, they're getting worse in a lot of areas.
That is a very, very good statement. That's the problem here. It's not just the losing. It is indeed the fact that they seem to be regressing from the Purdue win to the Michigan State loss to a very, very lackluster overtime win over Indiana to the blowout loss to Penn State. You're right. They are regressing, and that has to be the biggest concern. We're talking to Anthony Broom of MazeandBrew.com, a little postmortem on the Michigan loss at Happy Valley. Anthony, Jim Cushman's got a question for you.
And in terms of that, and I really like that assessment too, Anthony, that the team has been getting worse as we've gone forward, and that's obviously a huge red flag sign. I'm wondering about defensively. I mean, a couple of games into the season, right when Big Ten play is starting, the notion was, despite losing all those guys, look how good their defense is. What is gone on with them these last couple weeks? It's not just the two losses. It's the 42 to Penn State, and they're real solid. But it's the 20 also to Indiana, you know, as well. What's happened defensively these last couple weeks?
Yeah, well, let me say this. I'm not, despite what the final score says about Penn State, I'm not really worried about that defense. I think maybe the spotlight was a little too big for that group on Saturday. And you saw it. I mean, even pictures from before the game, there's a deer in the headlights look from a lot of those guys. And, you know, when they settled down a little bit, towards the latter half of the first half, you know, you saw them get off the field and make some plays. And, you know, even, Kalik Hudson could have had an interception literally standing in the end zone to put Michigan, right back in that game. So, I think the spotlight was a little too big in the Penn State game. I think in the Indiana game, to blow a 10-point lead with whatever it was, 4 minutes or 5 minutes left, a little bit concerning, but that was, to me, that was like a case of kind of letting your foot off the gas, which you can't do. And those are some of the kind of the growing pains that, you know, I expect on that side of the ball. So defense overall, I mean, Don Brown is getting a lot of hate for, you know, not being able to slow down Saquon Barkley, not being able not Trace McSorley. Well, guess what? No one else has been able to do that either. So, not that they get a free pass for that, because they should be better. But, you know, I think, again, last week that game in the whiteout conditions under the lights, and it's not an excuse, but I think that the stage was a little too bright. And again, when you're always on the field and when you're leaned on to make a play because your offense can't, that wears on you too.
We're talking to Anthony Broom, MazeandBrew.com, about the Michigan loss to Penn State. Just briefly on Penn State, is Saquon Barkley the real deal? He's widely considered to be the Heisman heavy, heavy favorite. Did he do anything to alter your perception of that as you watch this game?
Oh, I don't think so. I think he had a few slow weeks kind of before this Michigan game, and you know, the odds were that it wasn't going to. I thought that it wasn't going to happen for a third week, or however many weeks in a row it had been. The guy is insane. I think he'll wind up being a top five running back or draft pick, you know, right up there with like the Leonard Fournettes, the Ezekiel Elliotts of the world. That guy's insane. And he's crazy fun to watch. It's not fun to watch the team you cover, try and stop him, but you know, that guy is something special. And you know, he's got another national spotlight, coming up this weekend at Ohio State.
Yeah, no question about it, and that's a tough stretch for him and for them, by the way. I mean, what a brutal little run that is. They have to go through Michigan, Ohio State, and then Michigan State after that. But back to the Wolverines now. You say that 2018 starts now. Does Jim Harbaugh agree? Has he hinted at all as to what his game plan is going to be for going forward against Rutgers? I'm trying to look at the schedule. Rutgers, Minnesota, Maryland. So it's kind of a softer portion of the schedule the next 3 weeks anyway. Real opportunity to see some of the guys. You mentioned the center and so on. Is he going to be in full let's build for the future mode now, or does he recognize I still have to beat Wisconsin and I still have to try to beat Ohio State, you know, to get us to a New Year's Bowl and to, you know, to kind of keep the fans happy? I can't just be in rebuild mode here playing a bunch of young guys who may or may not be ready.
Yeah, I think more so on Peters. I'm not sure about a lot of the other guys, but I think, like I said before, you know, it serves, I mean, mathematically, they're not eliminated. I mean, some crazy things could happen, the next month or so. But, you know, you look at the stretch of games, they've got Rutgers at home, they've got Minnesota at home, they're going to Maryland. You know, they should be, there's no reason why they shouldn't be 3-0, no matter who they throw out there in those games. And if they're not, they lose any of these next three games, it, you know, that would be, I'll just say that would be pretty pathetic. But I think that in terms of Brandon Peters, I think there are rumblings that, you know, he's been giving, they're trying to get him a little more ready to play in practice. In terms of if he's going to start, I'm not sure. You know, it's going to be a matter of, you know, if he's ready to go. I know one of the concerns with him is that, you know, they're looking for him to be a little more vocal, to show he can lead a huddle, be a little more emphatic, so to speak, when he's on the field. So, like I said, I'm not sure. It seems like things are trending for them getting ready. I mean, he's the backup quarterback right now. So, you know, they certainly want him in a scenario where if John O'Connor was to go down, he's going to have to be ready anyway. So when Jim Harbaugh says we're getting him ready to play, I'm not sure if there's a quarterback switch that comes, but I think we're going to see him as soon as Saturday, whether it's, you know, in the second half of a blowout or whatever it may be. But, you know, well, Michigan hasn't really shown an ability to run away from anyone yet this year, so I don't know if you can bank on running up the score against Rutgers to get a guy like him some experience. So
nobody has, Anthony, real quick before we go, nobody has talked about Wilton Spate in a long time now. What's his status? What's his health status?
Last that I had seen of him, he was in a back brace. So I think that he's done for the year. Now, I don't have any insider info on that. I would not be surprised if he's just done for the year. You're right. It has been quiet. No, Harbaugh doesn't talk about injuries, but when he talked about Spates, he did say it would be multiple weeks. So, I'm not expecting him back anytime soon, if he comes back at all.
That's really an unfortunate thing because, you know, he worked very hard, obviously, last year in developing into the starter, and then a very tough, you know, fight throughout most of the spring and into camp, you know, to hold off O'Corn and to hold off, Peters, and just really an unfortunate thing. And all, as everybody talks about John O'Corn's struggles and the anticipation of a Peters, everybody seems to have forgotten about the poor injured guy over there who's only off the field now because of a health situation. So. Anthony, thanks for the update. We always appreciate getting your voice on all things Wolverines when we get a chance to talk to you here in Toledo. So thanks for the time today.
All right. Thank you again. We'll talk soon.
Look forward to it. Thanks much. All right. There's Anthony Broom talking about the Maize and Blue on the website, maizeandbrew.com. Maizeandbrew.com. Always good stuff there. Okay. Here's what we got coming up. We got a top of the hour sports center, local sports center coming your way. And before I get to the NFL, let me remind you, since we are on the Maize and Blue, the Wolverines, about the border battle contest. That Michigan-Ohio State game, I don't care how much Michigan has struggled in various situations. Michigan-Ohio State is still Michigan-Ohio State, and the border battle contest is up and running right now. The game is November 25th in Ann Arbor, and you could attend. Thanks to the ticket and Yingling with limo service from Total Image Limousine. That's right. If you're the grand prize winner of the Border Battle Contest, second prize, runner-up prize, is a trip for two to the Big Ten Championship game December 2nd at Lucas Oil Stadium in Indianapolis. So if you want to qualify, register now one time at 1065theticket.com or text the word Border Battle to 64636. Those who qualify will attend our giveaway party Thursday night, November 16th at the Blarney downtown. It's all brought to you by Yingling, True House of Munch, Get-Go Transportation, Churchill's Country Hearth, Tass Electronics, Distracted Haunted House, and your football friendly freaks here at ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. So coming up after the bottom or top of the hour local sports center, we're going to talk NFL and the Cleveland Browns. The Lions are obviously off this week, so I don't have much insight to advise there. But I will say that it's time for the Cleveland Browns to fire not only Hugh Jackson, the head coach who seems absolutely clueless in a million different ways, but also their front office. They gambled on a lawyer and a baseball scout to run a football operation, and it is failing big time. It's time to run them all out of town there in Cleveland. Scott Petrak, who covers those Browns on the beat, will join us to talk about it coming up right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
It feels great. There's no other way to put it. I mean, it's so easy to say, yeah, we want to win the World Series. I've been very fortunate my entire career to feel like I've had a team that we had a chance to win a World Series, and I've only been there twice, and that's over 12-plus years. So it's not easy. I don't take any of this for granted. This is what we play for. These are the experiences that you remember at the end of your career when you look back, you know, winning these games, playing in the World Series, hopefully winning a World Series. I think I've been here for, somebody said, like 50 days now. To feel this bonded to a team in a city that quickly, I think, is something special.
I'm really proud of my players and coaches. We were prepared. We knew we needed to get off to a great start. We certainly have a great deal of respect for USC, and this rivalry is one where our guys were excited about it. We made them aware of the history and tradition of it. We actually spent a little bit more time on how important this game was. Never did we take away from our preparation and how important that is. The turnovers obviously were key for us in the first half, and being opportunistic, which has been really what we've been all year. Getting up 28-0, you know, put us in such a great position in the second half to come back and get our program back to where it needed to be. And so all the credit goes to the players that were part of that. Just really proud of our players and coaches, and really good win for our football team.
And with our team, we saw it with our team. Nobody else can help us but us. We put our best people on it, you know, our players and our coaches. They were hitting on all cylinders. Yeah, quarterback was hot, and receivers made plays downfield, and it was impressive. Their execution was really good tonight, right from the beginning. Then we got a little bit under control, and then they came back and hit the quarterback sucker play. We're going to regroup. We're going to refit, retool, and get back to work. More opportunities ahead of us.
Routine run play. I mean, I've done it a million times where you're just blocking a guy and you go to try to finish him and get one last shove, one last push, and you just felt something unnatural in your arm. You kind of are in an out-of-body experience a little bit. I think you have an idea of what happened, at least, and you're trying to figure out if it's something that you can continue on with, if you can get up and keep playing, but effectively I really didn't have any function in my left arm. And I think you can play about 30% or 40% function with your one arm, but when you have no function in one arm, it's hard to block. Definitely proud of the number of plays I was able to put together, getting over that 10,000 milestone and going into my 11th season without missing a play is something that I always feel like I'll be able to hang my hat on and I can have pride in. It's a violent game, and those type of streaks, they always are going to come to an end.
That one's really personal to me. You know, he's a huge part of what we do, a huge part of this organization, and we'll see where that is. But that was a big blow, you know, because obviously those things, with him over there, it changes the game on how you have to call the game, try to protect those type of things. And they took advantage of that as we went. That's what good teams do. It's disappointing. I'm sure that he don't want the yo-yo, but it goes both ways. Developing quarterbacks, they still got to do what you ask them to do. So in that process of developing a quarterback, I want them to not turn the ball over. That's the name of the game. And again, I'm going to say it again, it's still about the football team. It's not just about one individual. It's about the team.
Yeah, I'm not here to talk about my personal life right now.
That doesn't show a lack of commitment to learning the job?
Absolutely not. You know, I was out and was at the facility the next day, you know, preparing for a game, was preparing for the game right before that. So, once again, I'm not here to talk about my personal life.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
It is indeed. Rolling onward. Thanks so much for joining us as we continue on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, where we are, Toledo sports leader. I've reached my wit's end. Rock bottom is no longer the depth. It's no longer the bottom. It's no longer the floor for the Cleveland Browns. They can go below rock bottom. I think they've done it. I think the field goal festival loss to the Tennessee Titans proves it. I think Hugh Jackson must be fired immediately. I think Sashi Brown and Paul DePodesta must be fired immediately. A lawyer and a baseball scout hired to run a football operation with a head coach who has no idea how to work with young players at the same time trying to win games. A coach who doesn't know how to, doesn't understand why you don't decline a penalty on 3rd and 1 at your own 23 in the first, I think it was a 23 in the first drive of the game. Oh, I'm sorry, 32, not 23. A coach who doesn't know how to or refuses to hire an offensive coordinator who can focus on calling the right plays and giving his young quarterback the best opportunity to succeed, trying to do it all himself. It is the biggest train wreck in the history of team sports, as far as I'm concerned. It is on its way to eclipsing the 0-26 start for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers when they were an expansion franchise. When they go 0-16 this year, and are thus 1-31 in their two seasons back-to-back, it will be the worst two-game season stretch in the history of the sport. And I'm done with it all. Joining us now to break it down, as if it can be broken down any more than they already are, is Scott Petrak, who is on the Browns beat, who joined us on Friday to talk about you know, a little bit of a preview of this game and an update on where they are. And I thought that was pretty much it. And no, not so much. It can get worse. It just did get worse. Scotty Petrak, thanks for the time. How are you?
I'm good, Bob. How are you?
I'm good. Hey, listen, before we get into the death penalty, which should be given, that's what they ought to do. They ought to give the Cleveland Browns organization the death penalty the way the NCAA did to SMU back in the 1980s for recruiting violations, just for violating the all precepts of professionalism that this franchise does not have. Before we get into all of that, Scott, I want to ask you about DeShone Kizer. As you know, and we've discussed, he's a Toledo product. He's the pride of Central Catholic High, starting quarterback of the Notre Dame Fighting Irish, now starting quarterback of the Cleveland Browns. And the little side note story of him being benched for the second time in three games is this video that was captured by somebody of him being out, not doing anything illegal, by the way, but him just being out at a club or a bar or wherever, late night Friday night. At about 1 o'clock in the morning, people, and I heard, I don't know whose voice that was, questioned his commitment to learning the offense because he happened to be out late at night on a Friday night on the weekend of a home game. Can you give us any insight into that, Scott, before we talk about the train wreck that is the entire organization?
Yeah, I mean, he was out. We just talked to him about 10 minutes ago, Bob.
Oh, you did? Okay, thank you. Said, what'd you
yeah, mean? Yeah. Well, you know, he said he took it upon himself for being a distraction. Said his mom wouldn't be proud of it. I think he's come to the point where he just knows it's a bad look for a team that's 0-7, for a team that's 1-22 in the last 2 years. You just can't bring this upon yourself. Now, you know, to me, it doesn't bother me. Like, my initial reaction is young guys go out. Friday night. They don't play till Sunday. They don't have to be in the facility till mid-afternoon Saturday. It's kind of their one night where they don't have anything going on. But I get that he just got the job back, that he talked about being more motivated, more committed to the starting role. And it doesn't look great when somebody else in the bar takes a video of you just standing there. I was doing a standing there,
yeah,
talking to another guy.
Nothing bad.
Right. But it's not the best optics, like people like to say these days. So I think he appreciates that part of it. Now, whether or not it'll happen again, he called it a rare thing that he stays out that, you know, that he's out that late. Usually doesn't happen. Thought he was as prepared as he needed to be for the game, and so did the teammates I talked to. So I think it's more of a public relations thing than a football thing.
I get all of the above. When is their Saturday workout? Is their Saturday workout early morning or is it afternoon?
No, it's mid-afternoon. They don't have to be in Berea until mid-afternoon for a home game, for Sunday home game.
Okay, so they don't have to be there until mid-afternoon. He's out at Friday night, a night in which probably lots of guys are going out, and if they're not doing anything illegal, they don't have to be up at 7 a.m. and in the facility. They don't have to be there until mid-afternoon. So there's no indication whatsoever that anything that this kid was doing on Friday night interfered with his game preparation, his ability to know the playbook, know the offensive game plan, make throws, make decisions. There's nothing about that night whatsoever that would have impacted his ability to play the game at the highest level he's capable of playing it. We agree on that?
Not any information that I have in that regard, Bob. You know, I have no reason to believe that he didn't get up Saturday and was fine and went about his business and came in and had a good workout Saturday. To me, it's about how it looks, and he admits that, and he admits that the distraction part is bad. He goes, my teammates are asking me about it today. They shouldn't have to be asking me about that. And he understands that it comes relatively quickly on the heels of Johnny Manziel, and we knew everything that entailed. So, you know, there's some moving parts to it, but the biggest moving part is that the Browns are so bad and they're easy to pile on, and it just doesn't look good for your quarterback who hasn't won a game and keeps throwing interceptions to be at a bar at 1:30 in the morning.
Yeah, I mean, I get it from an optic standpoint. I feel like if Johnny Manziel had not happened to that franchise,
yeah,
that this shouldn't be an issue and probably wouldn't be an issue. In part, I kind of blame the media, and that doesn't mean you specifically, but I don't know what you've written about it or what you plan to write about it, so you can answer that for yourself. But I feel like if the media focuses on that aspect of this train wreck season, this train wreck run, this train wreck regime, et cetera, if the media focuses on that as part of this, I just don't think it's fair because, you know, it is his private time. It is his personal time. He did not have a curfew on a Friday night like you would on the night before a game. He didn't violate any team rules. He didn't violate any laws. If he wants to, after what I believe to be probably, you know, many, many hours of preparing, studying film, and trying to do everything he can to get better, if he wants to go out on a Friday night and relax for a while, and it's not like he was out there drinking and dancing that we know of, if he wants to go out and just relax a little while and the night extends a little deeper than he maybe otherwise might want it to, I feel like it's wrong. I feel like it's wrong for the media and then thus the fans who read the media to focus on that as part of this mess. Am I wrong about that?
You know, no, I tend to agree with that, and that was my initial reaction. And if somebody sent me the video, I don't think I would have made a big deal about it at all.
Okay.
But having said that, I texted a quarterback that I know who's played in this league before and said that is a cornerback. And I'm not looking at the text because I'm talking to you. But the thing was, he doesn't love that from a quarterback, especially a rookie quarterback. And I think we do have different standards, and I think teams and teammates have different standards for their quarterback. So while he has every right to do it, I think coaches and teammates would prefer if their quarterback was, you know, snuggled in his bed at 10 o'clock on a Friday night.
Yeah, I'm sure they would. I'm sure they would prefer that. But like I said, I just feel like, again, if Manziel hadn't happened, and if this team wasn't the biggest joke in the history of the National Football League, this is, in other words, if he's doing the exact same thing for Denver, you know, and they're, yeah. Whatever, what are they, 3-3 or something like that, and it, pretty much anywhere else, I don't think this is as big of a deal, and I don't think the media in that town would think of it was as big of a deal. But it is Cleveland. The media there are feasting on the Browns' failure. I'm part of that from a different perspective. I mean, I'm not in Cleveland, but every day on social media, I rip and destroy those guys, and I do it here on the radio in Northwest Ohio where there's a lot of Browns fans. I feel like that the media is feasting on this, and that's why it's just a little unfair to DeShone Kizer. He's got enough problems
with his
performance on the field that this is piling on.
Right. Yeah, but let me just add one more thing. Hugh Jackson could have said, hey, it's fine. That's his own time. But he said he's on his personal time, but I don't think DeShone would do that. That's not who DeShone is. And then he said, well, we have video, and he's caught off guard. Right. And then Ricardo Lewis, one of the receivers, said, I don't really like that. So it's not just the media. The coach and the teammate weren't happy with DeShone being out that late.
Agreed. And that media, by the way, again, fed that, though, by saying, we've got video. So, and I know it was a TV media, so then what do they do? They're all about video, so I get it. And
sure.
I understand that. And let's pivot now to Hugh Jackson on this, because yeah. I started the conversation as I started my show today saying it's time for him to be fired. I feel as though, even though you're right, he was caught off guard by this saying we have video. For him to say, oh, it's good to know. I'm really glad to know that. Thank you, blah, blah, blah. And appreciative of this knowledge. Well, because maybe that explains a little bit about DeShone and maybe justifies his very strange decision to bench this kid for performance reasons for the second time in 3 weeks. He's supposed to be the quarterback whispering guru who's going to develop this young kid, live with his mistakes through thick and thin, as he said at the start of the season when he cut Brock Osweiler, named him the starter. He said, we're going to live and grow through the valleys and peaks with DeShone Kizer because we think he's got the goods. Now that the pressure of 0-5 was on, then 0-6, and now 0-7 is on, and he knows that his time is running out, now it's, well, we got to win a game immediately, and if Cody Kinkesler can give us a lift, the hell with this development of the young kid that I promised I would do. And I think, well, now it's not just me. Look, now that we know this, he's not necessarily even the most committed to getting this development done either. I think Hugh Jackson may have used that a little bit to excuse his own decisions.
Maybe. The thanks for sharing that to me was complete sarcasm, and he was upset that the PR staff hadn't informed him before he got that question. He shot a look that, if you haven't seen the video, shot a look like, I can't believe you left me in this spot. So,
is he right about that, by the way? Did the PR staff drop the ball there? Is this just another function of a dysfunctional franchise where they didn't do their job?
Yeah, to me, that's not my place to put blame there. You know, I don't know the inner workings. I don't know the right after the game or how much time he spends with them.
All right.
You know, it happened late Sunday morning. But going back to the real crux here is I agree completely with the fact that Hugh Jackson has butchered the development of Deshaun Kizer. And it's not too late to save it. There's 9 games left, but Hugh doesn't sound like he's committed to him right now. He hasn't decided who his quarterback's going to be for this week. He's talked about maybe the rest of the year he'll have guys in and out of the lineup. And we already know the season's lost. And I get that Hugh Jackson doesn't agree with that philosophy and that he's all about trying to win some games and save a job. And he's got 52 other guys to worry about. That shouldn't be ignored. But this season also has to be about identifying Deshaun Kizer as your, if he can be your franchise quarterback. And to me, those interceptions he threw yesterday need to be viewed. You can't lump them in with the other 9 he's thrown. All right. He completed 6 straight to start the game. He was having a good first half. He threw a ball, deep ball down the middle. It got away from him. That happened. Then he's rolling right. The guy's open. The safety made a really good play. Dropped back. It feels like a rookie mistake that would happen to a lot of quarterbacks. And yet Hugh Jackson doesn't give him the chance to respond to those mistakes. And that's a problem I have.
I do too. That is exactly the problem I have. And again, now it comes down to the question of what is his real motivation here? Is it just frustration with Deshaun Kizer and I can't have somebody turning the ball over, or is it I don't have a win yet this season? I have won in 20. What is it now? How many games? 16 and
17, one in 23
games. I can't do this. The victory and my own butt. Saving my own butt, CYA, covering my own butt here is going to take priority over developing this kid. If his picks are going to cost me a game here that I desperately need to win to keep the Wolves away from the door, then that's what I have to do. Is it self-preservation that is motivating Hugh Jackson? And if so, how can he continue to coach this team?
Yeah, I think they're tied. You know, they're hand-in-hand, self-preservation, trying to get a win, and knowing you can't have your quarterback turn the ball over at the rate Deshaun Kizer has turned the ball over. Mm-hmm. I think those are together. But I think at the top of the list is his desperation for a win. Whether or not that is only to keep his job. Maybe it's just these guys do all they can to win games in this league. They work countless hours to win games. And when you're on the sideline on Sunday, I think the things you talk about Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday go out the window because it's, man, we're down 6-3. Maybe Cody Kessler can save this game for me. And I think you lose sight of, hey, this is a good chance for Deshaun Kizer to learn a lesson. Or, you know, you get caught up in the game, and I think that's natural, but I think it's counterproductive in this situation and where the Browns are as a team right now. And it'll be interesting to see how Hugh handles it moving forward. You know, he was asked about it today. He goes, do you feel like you're coaching for your job? And he said, no. He goes, you know, he has a good relationship with Jimmy and Dee Haslam and open lines of communication. And he said, if I did feel that way, I would tell you. Now, who knows? It's a good quote. But maybe he really doesn't believe he's coaching for his job. But if he doesn't, then that makes the quarterback decision even more curious.
That's a very good point. If he feels secure, then why are you not committing yourself to what you said you were committed to, which is developing this kid to find out if he's the real deal, or I believe he already is the real deal. That's why you wanted to draft him and making him the quarterback, franchise quarterback of the future. So why then, if you are secure in yourself, why are you doing this and yo-yoing this kid? And you heard him in that clip we played, or I think you did, Scott, where he said, I don't want to yo-yo a guy, but it's a two-way street. He's got to also do his part of the job and not turn the ball over like that. Isn't that part of developing a quarterback, living with the turnovers, living with the mistakes on this throw and that throw, rather than the, I hope your neck isn't sore from looking over your shoulder now that you know that every time you make a mistake, I'm going to yank you.
Yes, in my opinion, it is. And I think Hugh needs to live with these mistakes. What Hugh would tell you is, I've stressed from day one, a quarterback cannot turn the ball over in this league. So if I've stressed it for 5 months or whatever that number is, and the kid keeps doing it, how am I going to get through to him? And the way Hugh's trying to get through to him is by benching him. I disagree with that philosophy at this point. Now, maybe at some point I would say, you know what, I've seen enough, you have to do something, but I haven't gotten to that point. And part of that is because I think 2 alternatives, Kevin Hogan and Cody Kessler, don't give you much better chance to win, so why not ride it out with a rookie who might develop into a franchise quarterback? But that's what he would tell you is, number one rule, we can't turn it over, and the kid keeps breaking the rule, this is how I have to react.
Yeah, I mean, if he had a veteran over there that you knew would be able to stabilize things, it would be in there. Okay, let's bring you over here and let's stand you here, not as a punishment, not because you turned it over, but because you've got to learn how and why you turned it over and how not to do that. Let's watch this veteran show you some things maybe that you haven't seen before, but you don't have a veteran. You got Kessler right. And Hogan, who are Hogan. You know, I mean, Kessler did start 8 games last year, but I mean, who have no more of a reputation in this league than Kizer does. So what in the world is there to benefit from doing this to him? Let's move on to a couple of other guys and a couple of other things. Kenny Britt continues to underperform in the field. He continues to disappoint off the field. He does violate curfews when there are curfews. He has just been about the worst signing, the worst free agent signing, I think, that this team has had in a long time. I'd have to go back and try to look at some of the other disasters. But he has just been horrific. He is not only not helping this team as a leader, a veteran of a young receiving core that is under-talented and inexperienced, he's not only not helping, I think he's officially hurting this team. I think he is a negative influence on it, both in performance and off the field. What are they going to do with him?
Yeah, I think there's a chance he could be cut in the next 48 hours.
Really?
I don't know that's going to happen. I asked Hugh. He was talking about you have to give guys chances, right? And we know Kenny's blown through some, and I said, well, Hugh, does he get another chance? And he goes, we're going to have to see about that. So I think those are organizational decisions. But I feel like they've come to the point where, you know what, we gave this guy 2 weeks off with a groin injury. We sent him home from Houston. Last week was the week. Yesterday was the game against the Titans, the team that drafted him. He was going to play, he played a ton of snaps. This is a chance for him to say, all right, I have something left. I can show you from here on out, I'm going to be the guy that you spent a lot of money on. And he came out and caught 2 passes for 7 yards and didn't make a catch in overtime that could have changed the outcome. And I think Hugh Jackson says, you know what, while Kenny probably has as much talent as any receiver on this roster, which isn't saying much,
right?
He says, you know what, it's no longer worth it. I'm going to play the young guys, and they're going to be bad, but at least they're young and bad and cheap and bad, not, you know, a veteran who's a bad influence, and I agree with you completely. I think he's a bad influence on Corey Coleman, who's already susceptible to that, and there's already question marks about his kind of attitude. I just don't think having Kenny Britt on this roster serves a purpose any longer.
I completely agree. Let me ask you about one more guy before we talk about Joe Thomas and the end of the streak. Isaiah Crowell got a season high, I think. I don't have all the stats in front of me, but they haven't run the ball very much. But he got 17 carries and averaged 2 yards a carry. I don't know if that's as much a statement on him as the offensive line or the running game in total, but very, very disappointing for a guy who came in with really, really high hopes and a lot of big talk because he – if you remember in the offseason, he was asked about the best backs in the league. He included himself as one of the top 5 backs in the league. He's, you know, you run for 2 yards a carry when you finally – he's been asking for more carries too. And I think he's deserved them because I think, you know, throwing the ball as frequently percentage-wise as the Browns were with Deshaun doesn't do Deshaun any favors. And it really does, a disservice to the, you know, chance for the running game to get on track as well. So he got an opportunity and did not do much with it.
Yeah, and that's disappointing. I do think Isaiah is still a legitimate starting running back in this league. He's not top 5. He's not top 10. I don't know where he fits on the scale. I think you can have a successful team with him as your running back. I think he hasn't run great. The line hasn't blocked great. And what's the biggest reason is none of these defenses fear the passing game because you have a rookie quarterback, because you have bad receivers. So therefore, they say if we take away the run, this team's got nothing, and it's like beating your head against the wall. So the numbers are bad. Carroll has not been as good as I'm sure he thought he would be this year, and he shares some of that blame. But I think the biggest blame is the offense can't function the way it needs to with the passing game being as limited as it is.
Joe Thomas sees the most amazing Iron Man streak that we have ever seen come to an end there. Season is over. Boy, if you're going to miss a game, you might as well make it really count. It's a torn triceps tendon, and he's out for the whole season. He's not going to miss a game or a snap on something small. It's going to be big, and it is. I don't have a real question here about how they recover from that because you don't replace a guy like that. You just have somebody play left tackle while he's gone. But just your thoughts on the streak itself and what it meant for that guy and the disappointment of it ending.
Yeah, it's just going to be so weird, Bob, to not see him out there next Sunday. You know, they're going to be in London, and somebody else is going to play left tackle. And it's been more than a decade since that's been the case. And you can't say that about anything in this league. Nobody plays that long in this league. I saw that yesterday that 2% of the players last year played every snap for their team. And he's done it for 10 and a half years. So it's remarkable. Center J.C. Treader said he thinks it's the most he goes, this is a game filled with stats. Because I think that's the most impressive stat I've ever seen. And not only that, Joe is unbelievable off the field. You know, from a media perspective, he stayed after the game yesterday to talk to the media and called in today on a conference call to update us. His teammates love him. I'm sure he'll be around and trying to coach them up during the week. It's sad because you know, like, if he had been able to finish his career, whatever it was, 11, 12, 13 years without missing a snap, that would have been truly remarkable. His streak is truly remarkable, but that would have been a way to go out, and I just feel bad for him.
I do, too. I feel bad for him that he's stuck in that franchise, too. He's loyal.
Yeah.
He's loyal. He has proven that time and again as he continues to sign new contracts to stay. And he could have gone so many different times. He could have asked for trades. He could have made himself a pain in the rear end to go to try to play in a playoff game for once, to try to get to a Super Bowl and cap his Hall of Fame career with a championship, and he's never done it, and I just feel terrible for him. And I wonder if maybe this end of this streak now, maybe, I don't know, creates a whole new turning over of a leaf thing. That streak is over when I come back healthy next year. You know what? I don't know. I wish there was a way for him to get out of this train wreck because it is so unbecoming of him. The professionalism or the lack thereof in that organization is just undeserving of Joe Thomas's loyalty, which brings me back to my original question. I honest to God, and I know that stability is what you shoot for. Stability is what the Patriots have. It's what the Steelers have. It's what the great teams that stay competitors and contenders for championships and are indeed repeat championship teams time and again. It's what they have in common is stability. They don't go firing people after bad stretches all the time. Having said that, and the Browns have been the exact opposite, as they have turned over new coaches every year and a half or 2 years for the last 10 years, it seems, and new regimes and new club presidents and all the executive VPs and GMs and so on and so forth. I know change is the enemy of you know, building a successful long-term team, but they cannot keep this group. I think Hugh Jackson, who can't manage a game, whose excuse for declining a penalty, a 15-yard penalty on third and one from your own 32 at the beginning, I mean from in-game decisions to the quarterback mangling we talked about to the play calling and the no offensive coordinator, and then to the fact that the front office, as it's comprised, has given him the worst roster in football, they cannot keep this group. I feel like they all need to be fired tomorrow. Get him the hell out of town. Don't even let him or fire him on the way back from London if you want. But Sashi Brown, Paul D. Podesta, analytics, and your little laptop doesn't work in football the way it did in baseball. I'm sorry. I just feel like you blow the whole damn thing up. And if I had my druthers, and I know I just sound like I'm an angry, bitter fan, I would tell Jimmy Haslam to put the team up for sale at the same time, since he's the one who hired all of the above. I feel like at the very least, Hugh has to go. Do you agree, or you want to ride this out?
I think it's headed. I think it's headed in that direction. You know, I don't see it getting any better this year. So let's assume it doesn't get any better this year, and they win 0-1 or 2 games. I don't see any way Jimmy Haslam keeps the status quo. I don't know if that means hiring somebody above Sashi Brown to make the football decisions and trying to maintain some sense of continuity. But I would be shocked if Sashi and or Hugh came back, unless there's a drastic improvement, Bob, because you just can't get away from 1-22. You just can't get away from it, and that's where they are, and there's no reason to believe it's going to get better this season. I think we're headed there.
But you think it will event? You think it will only happen after the season? You don't think he'll move in season?
Well, here's what I'll tell you. It's not going to happen tomorrow, but it wouldn't shock me if there's a coaching change coming back from London, assuming they lose in London. It's the bye week. It's happened multiple times before in the league. I don't have any sense that Jimmy's close to doing it. It is a logical spot for it to happen. I think you have to keep your ears open, and have to pay attention, because something like that could happen. I think it's trickier with the front office. You know, you have to have a structure. There's moves to be made during the season. Not that it's not tricky from the offense. You know, you got to have a coordinator. You have some a head coach. So there's a lot of moving pieces. But I guess the point is everything's on the table when you've been this bad for a year and a half, and Jimmy Haslam knows it.
Scott Petrak on the Browns beat talking about the train wreck, the mishandling of Deshaun Kizer, and more. Scott, I'm going to wrap by reading you the rest of the schedule, and when I say the team that the Browns will beat, I want you to say stop. All right?
All right.
Vikings, Lions, Jaguars, Bengals, Chargers, Packers.
Maybe.
Where? Chargers?
Maybe Chargers.
Packers because of Hundley. Or the lack of Rodgers.
No, I give him a better chance against the Chargers.
Oh, Chargers. Oh, that's what. So when you said maybe,
yeah,
okay, Chargers. Maybe against the Chargers.
Yeah.
After Packers is Ravens, Bears, Steelers. So
yeah,
I didn't hear a stop from you in nine teams. I got a maybe on the Chargers. That's it.
Yeah. Well, I think Chicago and Baltimore are also maybes, depending on where they are in the season. You know, if Baltimore out of the playoff contention, that kind of thing. But, you know, Bob, they're not going to be favored the rest of the year. I can't imagine, right?
What about the Bengals? And I know they lost to the Bengals already badly, but you saw what Pittsburgh just did to them. Cincinnati's falling apart.
Yeah, but you're going on the road. I mean, maybe, you know, I mean, you never know late in the season with teams who have gone in the tank. You know, their coaches are in trouble. You just never know. But I'll tell you this, I can't imagine they're going to be favored the rest of the season.
No.
You know?
No, they can't be. I mean, not in any home game. Who are the home games? Baltimore, Green Bay, Jacksonville, Minnesota's in London, so that's it. So Baltimore, Green Bay, Jacksonville. Yeah, even at home, I think they'll be dogs in all of them, and they should be, especially if we don't know who the quarterback is going to be or anything else. So it's
They just got through the softest part of their schedule, and they lost two terrible games at home and got blown out twice. You know?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly right. That's exactly right. The next 3 weeks are good. I mean, I wouldn't have thought this at the start of the season as everybody complained about Blake Bortles and Chad Henne. But Jacksonville is suddenly tough and on top of the division in the South, for crying out loud. Detroit will be favored. Minnesota will be favored in London. You're right. The next 3 weeks are not favorable to them. Then we get Cincy, which we described, and the Chargers after that. So we'll see. But anyway, Scott, thanks for sifting through all of the trash coming out of Berea, and that's all it is. They are producers of trash. The infamous video that was done a few years ago about the factory of sadness is still accurate, but I also think it is a factory of trash because they produce it, manufacture it, and export it to the fans on a weekly basis. And it's sad that the fans actually keep buying it. Scott Petrak on the Browns beat. Scotty, thanks for the time, my friend. I always appreciate your input.
Thanks, bud.
You got it. 4:43, local sports center coming your way. We'll come right back after that on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Once again, it's the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yeah, buddy, winding it down on a Monday afternoon right here on The Ticket. We got Drive Time coming your way at the top of the hour, or shortly after the top of the hour, sports center anyway, with Mike Miller, so stick around for that. Kush, since we only have about 5 minutes left, I want to go through a few things rapid fire.
Sure.
And just hit some news. How about your boy Dwayne Wade?
Yeah.
Coming to Cleveland to play with his buddy. Remember the two of them?
We're
like peanut butter and jelly. We just go together, and that's what I'm here for. And immediately he was given the starting job in the Cavaliers lineup. J.R. Smith goes to the bench very, very unhappily. Here we are, three games in. Dwayne Wade averaging 5.7 points on 8.3 shots. Was 2-for-8 in the loss to Orlando on Saturday. And he's going to the bench. He spins it as my request. It doesn't feel right. I want to help this team win. I have asked the coach to sit me down and let JR start, and I'll come off of the bench and do my thing. You buying it?
I'm not buying that particular line of reasoning from Wade, though I will give him a tip of the cap for attempting to do that. Honestly, Bob, this is the move that should have been made the whole time, because when you really think about a starting lineup with Isaiah Thomas hurt and using both Derrick Rose and Dwayne Wade as your starting backcourt, the first thing that jumps out at me is this team suddenly has no ability to shoot the three ball anymore. None. So I'm fine with this kind of switch, and that would make Wade one of the more focal points of a second unit, which at this stage of his career and given the rest of this team is probably better for everybody.
I just hate the, you know, we're going to make him look good, like he has seen this, and he doesn't think it's working this way, so he's going to be the self-sacrificing guy who goes to the bench to help the team. He knew he was going to be benched.
Yeah,
he knew
I think
full
he did too.
Well that Ty Lue was not going to let him continue to start and play the way he was playing, which is terrible. It doesn't fit. It doesn't work. He's not the guy that LeBron played with in Miami. He is much older than his body would indicate. His body is much older than his age would indicate, I should say. Unlike LeBron James, who is still in phenomenal shape, 2 years younger than Wade, he is just not going to be able to be that guy. His role should be coming off of the bench. And Brian Windhorst reported
the same.
I do want
to get to Dwayne Wade earlier today. Ty Lue revealed that Wade came to him and asked to move back to the second unit. That means J.R. Smith back in the starting five. I mean, Wade, so far it's the smallest sample size ever, but he's ninth on the team in scoring so far, and he spoke about the move at practice today.
You know, I just decided earlier than later just to get to the unit where, you know, I'll be more comfortable in, and, you know, can probably be better with this team in that lineup. So why wait, you know, three games in, you know, why wait? I wanted to get in there, you know, with those guys.
I think the big headline.
Again, Brian, you heard what he said in that clip. Mm. I decided to do it now rather than wait. Why wait? As if it's his decision,
right.
Self-sacrificing. Was that really what happened, though, Brian Windhorst?
I got a lot of texts this morning from NBA folks. Was this the Cavs' call or was this Wade's call? And they just put a nice spin on it. I think it's sort of in between. I think Dwayne saw the writing on the wall that this wasn't working. He said after the game Saturday night, which was a disaster loss by the Cavs to the Magic, he said, I'm still trying to find my role here. You gotta think about this. 14 years, he's been a number one or a number two option.
Yep.
And I think the Cavs, out of respect, wanted to see if it would work. And I think they were willing to let it go further. But I think Dwayne knew eventually it was going to be the second unit for him, and he stepped up and said, okay, let's do it now.
Bingo. He knew he was going to go to the bench. That's the part there, and he stepped up. In other words, in order to avoid the headline that said Dwayne Wade sent to the bench, Cavaliers, Lue puts Wade on the bench, returns Smith to the starting lineup. He spins it to the, oh, I decided it was time for me to do that. So, like I said, a couple of other rapid-fire ones real quick. LaVert Hill of the Wolverines, not making a lot of fans in Happy Valley. He had to apologize for the bird. Flipped off the fans in Happy Valley and had to apologize, saying he sincerely regrets his inappropriate gesture at the end of a football game. Any big deal for you that LaVert Hill made that gesture, and is a simple apology good enough, or does that indicate that maybe Jim Harbaugh didn't have control of his guy?
I don't think it's the latter so much as he just went off, basically. And guys do that. I mean, Kyrie did something like that and got fined in the NBA a couple days ago. It happens.
And finally, since the music is playing, only one more in the rapid-fire segment. Jim McElwain, Florida Gators coach. I referenced this when I talked to Anthony Broome before. He, his staff, and players are getting death threats from Florida Gators fans over their 3-3 start. What in the hell is wrong with people?
Seriously.
I mean, it's college football. Hell, even if it was the, you know, the National Football League and your team was off to a poor start. Death threats? To college kids, for crying out loud, what the hell is wrong with people there? I know that's a rhetorical question. You don't have to answer it. I just wanted to point out the absurdity of it all, as well as the absurdity of a wide receiver for a 5-2 football team that might be Super Bowl bound wanting a trade because he's not getting enough balls thrown his way. You talk about the height of selfishness. Yes, your name is Martavis Bryant of the Pittsburgh Steelers. We'll get into that a little bit more tomorrow. World Series talk tomorrow, as well as Justin Verlander and the Astros take on the Dodgers, but that'll be tomorrow's show. Drive Time is coming up next for today right here on The Ticket. We'll see you.